Hi, it's Tracy. Before we start, I have a request. Okay, it's a little weird, maybe even a lot weird, but hello, 6.5 million downloads on my podcast, and still we haven't chosen a sponsor, right? Yeah, they just haven't been good enough for us, and that's a little weird too. So I decided I'm going to treat this like a sponsorship spot. Many of you know Marcus, my son, who's been the inspiration behind this podcast, the book, my programs, anything at all to do with ADHD. Well, he is graduating from NYU this May, and boy, are we happy that he did it in 4 years. So anyway, Marcus loves to travel, and so he's spending 6 weeks by himself traveling to 5 countries in South America. I don't know about you, but there's no way in hell that I would go to even one country alone. And so we gave Marcus a very low budget. This trip is a combination of his birthday and graduation gift, and he figured it all out himself. He speaks some Spanish, but he hired a Spanish tutor from Ecuador a couple weeks ago, months maybe, who's a professor at a university there, and this professor is helping him with his conversational Spanish. Marcus also changed his phone to Spanish only and all of his apps, and he only watches Spanish TV in preparation for this trip. So that gives you a little bit of an idea of what Marcus is like. Now, Marcus would ultimately like to earn a PhD in psychology. He's fascinated by the brain, learning differences, and particularly how dyslexia impacts math. For the near future, though, he wants to work for a couple of years in New York City. I never thought he'd say that. He was always looking for more nature. So anyway, he's going on this trip, and what he's trying to do is find a job that he can come back to. He's come very close, but still no cigar. So yes, I am hawking my son's skills on these airwaves. He thinks I'm insane. But I'm like, who knows what interesting people are out there? I mean, I found my husband in a personal ad when no one was doing that. So why not find a job using my podcast? I mean, ultimately, finding a partner or finding a job, it's all the same thing, right? It's marketing, just getting the word out. Right job, right person. So that's my weird request. If you have any leads in New York City, Marcus would love to work in advertising or marketing sales. He's a phenomenal researcher. I promise you, he can find anything. He's very skilled in Excel and financial modeling. He'd be amazing in digital advertising or tech marketing. And beyond his hard skills, he's resilient. He's so smart. And he has an exceptional work ethic. And that's not just his mother talking. He's not like me. He prefers not to challenge the status quo all the time. He actually likes structure and systems. And he has so many ideas about how to make things better, faster, more efficient, simpler. So I'm putting this out there to our incredible community. If you know of any opportunities in digital advertising, tech marketing, or sales that are in New York City and could benefit from a bright, hardworking, and respectful young professional like my son Marcus, send me an email at support@tracyoutsuka.com and I will connect the two of you. Look, Marcus represents the very essence of what we talk about here every week, right? The brilliance of thinking differently. And so does his mother. So thank you for letting me be weird. And now let's get on with the show.
I did this for me, you see, so that I could improve. And then the byproduct of it being offered as a service came secondary to that. So it was not the primary goal of me learning. It was all for myself. And I think that's the best teacher, because when you have gone through it yourself, you can relate to the person in front of you on the other side of the phone or the other side of the consultation, and you know what they're telling you. You know, you can understand, yep. You can empathize, you know, with it. And it's not like you're talking to a brick wall. There's empathy, you know, there's confidence because you have lived through it and got through to the other side and you live to tell the story, so to speak. And it gives a lot of hope to other women is what I believe.
Thomas Edison, Richard Branson, John F. Kennedy, Mozart, Michael Jordan, Will Smith. That sounds like a list of highly successful titans in a variety of vocations. Why is it that we rarely hear that they have or had ADHD? And you know what we hear even less about? Serena Williams, Emma Watson, Mel Robbins, Whoopi Goldberg, Agatha Christie, Erin Brockovich, Cher. Yeah, the successful women navigating ADHD. And that's exactly why I started this podcast, ADHD for Smartass Women. I'm your host, Tracy Otsuka. I'm a lawyer, not a doctor, a lifelong student, now a coach. I'm also the creator of Your ADHD Brain is A-OK, a system that helps people like you figure out what they should do with their life. And we're here today to talk ADHD, your strengths, your symptoms, your workarounds, and how you proudly stand out instead of trying to fit in. I credit my ADHD for some of my greatest gifts. And you know what? I spy a happier life for you, too. So without further ado, a shiny new episode is starting now. Hello, I am your host, Tracy Otsuka. Thank you so much for joining me here for episode number 159 of ADHD for Smartass Women. I hope you'll subscribe to this podcast and our newsletter over at tracyotsuka.com. My purpose is always to show you who you are and then inspire you to be it. In the thousands of ADHD women that I have had the privilege of meeting, I've never met a one that wasn't truly brilliant at something, not one. So I am especially delighted to introduce you to Dr. Susan Vargas. Dr. Vargas is a general practitioner, family physician based in London and Dubai. She has over 20 years of extensive experience in women's health and internal medicine, with a special interest in lifestyle medicine, menopause, ADHD, and holistic health. Her interest in ADHD stems from her own personal experience and awareness of ADHD traits, which became apparent in perimenopause during the COVID lockdown. I've heard that story often. She provides coaching and advisory services to assist women in their 40s and 50s with ADHD and menopause using an evidence-based holistic lifestyle approach and signposts to specialists. Susan, did I get all of that right?
You summed it up perfectly well, Tracy. Thank you so much for having me on your podcast. And I must say, yours was one of the first podcasts I started listening to a few months ago when I was going through this at the start of my ADHD journey. So thank you so much. I feel privileged to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here. So can we talk about your ADHD diagnoses first?
Yes, fairly late, and it was just diagnosed some time ago during menopause in the COVID lockdown. And I wasn't diagnosed with ADHD in my childhood or teens. And as you well know, you know, the number of girls and number of women with ADHD who go undiagnosed when they're especially supported during the early years is pretty high. So, you know, I lived in a society with firm boundaries, both in at school and in my family and home life. So I think because I did very well at school and into med school as well, it went undiagnosed for a very long time. So it was only into my mid-40s that a lot of the ADHD traits became apparent.
So what were some of the symptoms, the traits that you're talking about that you were starting to experience?
I think probably say one of the main things I realized was it took me a lot longer to organize things than other people. And it could be organization, you know, personal life, you know, parties, or it could be just organizing my own life, you know, including things like laundry, you know, common things, you know, I could do complicated things very well, like in my medical profession. But when it came to more simplistic traits, like, you know, keeping on top of my accounting or laundry or cleaning and things like that, those kind of things took a backseat. And also, I think my perfectionism, which kind of accounts for my consciousness at work, kind of looking after the health and well-being of other people, it left me quite exhausted. So that perfectionism drove me to the level of exhaustion, which made me struggle. And this on top of, you know, kind of the physical symptoms of perimenopause with the tiredness, and everything just compounded. And it was just like, it was a explosion, something that I didn't expect. So being a medical professional, you know, for me, it came as a shock. And I found that really scary. So that's where my symptoms started.
So were you like me that initially you were like, oh my gosh, do I have early onset dementia?
You don't know what all the questions I've asked myself. Is it early onset dementia? Do I need to give up medicine? Or am I going crazy? All the usual things that women in their mid-40s would ask went through my mind. You know, what if there's something else going on? The paranoia, the hypochondriac side of me kicks in. It's like, what is going on? How can I miss things? I shouldn't be missing things. I'm a doctor. So I think that put a lot of pressure on me on myself, really, to be perfect. And I can't be this perfect Susan. So then who am I then if I'm not my usual Susan? I'm used to the one who gets 100%, who does everything perfectly. So I think that's where it kind of came as a shock, really. So, and that was a really difficult journey as well, because you go down the spiral very quickly. And if you don't get the right support at the right time, and you're not surrounded by the right people, you could end up somewhere in a really dark place and find it really hard to come back out of that spiral or the hole you've dug yourself in.
Absolutely. Especially if you go to a medical professional and they start telling you, oh, it's just anxiety. It's just depression. So here's medication for that, which then makes the ADHD symptoms often worse, right?
Exactly. And I think I didn't even have the privilege of doing that, because it was just at the beginning of the COVID pandemic and London went into lockdown pretty quickly. So you couldn't really see anyone face to face, medical professional wise. So, and all the doctors were inundated with COVID patients. So you couldn't really see anyone, speak to anyone. So I think that added to the delay, but then it kind of empowered me, because then it gave me the time, you know what, I have to research things for myself. I need to educate myself about ADHD. I need to educate myself about perimenopause. So I think the whole inspiration behind my coaching and advisory service for women with ADHD and or menopause stems from my own personal experience, my own journey. And you don't have to reinvent the wheel, you know, when someone has done the homework for you. And, yeah, you know, I think I've been lucky, because as a medical doctor, when I come across studies or journals and papers or articles, I have the discretion, okay, is it actually evidence-based, is it sound, yes, information? Because that's the thing I think a lot of women struggle with. They read a lot of rubbish in the media and you don't really know who to trust, what to trust, and, you know, where do you go next? So, and if you don't know where you're going next, you know, then you're in a dark hole, and that makes things more difficult, and it just adds to the frustration. And I think you asked me about the symptom, coming back to it. I think the frustration of not knowing. And, you know, I think as perfectionists, as a high achiever, you always want to be in control, you know. And I think the more control I lost, the more anxious I kind of became, the more controlling in my own head. You know, I wanted to know everything. I mean, it's a good thing, because you see, that's exactly what makes me a really good doctor, which is what I believe, you know, the flip side of the ADHD. I think deciphering the information out there, that is the key, and knowing what to trust and who to trust.
So many of us were women, were diagnosed because our kids were diagnosed.
Exactly.
How did you, and I know you're a doctor, but so many doctors, they don't know about ADHD because they weren't taught about ADHD. It's just something out there that, you know, young boys have. Did you always have experience with ADHD? And so you could recognize these symptoms and right away say, ah, that must be ADHD? Or how did that happen?
Not at all. Far from it. None of the ADHD things were covered in the medical school curriculum. And, you know, if at all, like you said, the hyperactive, overactive young boys, that is the ADHD template every doctor has in their head. And I think it was coming into my mid-40s. And actually, it was my brother, who's not a medical professional, and he was reading through some resources for men. And it was from a US-based ADHD coach, and my brother turned around and asked me, do you think you have ADHD? And I was like, what made you even ask me that question? So I was shocked. And you know, and like most people who are well educated and who think they know everything, and that's a lot of doctors for you. And I kind of was very dismissive. I was like, no, I don't have ADHD. I would have known, you know, if I'd had ADHD, I wouldn't get through med school. I wouldn't have all these qualifications, all these letters after my name. I don't think I would get to where I am today with the ADHD. So it was very, the dismissal comes from not knowing and the ignorance. But then you see, when you start struggling with it on a practical day-to-day level, you're forced to look yourself in the mirror and then examine what is out there. And I had to read everything from scratch and learn everything about it in the last, I would say, 18, 20 months. I did this for me, you see, so that I could improve. And then the byproduct of it being offered as a service came secondary to that. So it was not the primary goal of me learning. It was all for myself. And I think that's the best teacher, because when you have gone through it yourself, you can relate to the person in front of you on the other side of the phone or the other side of the consultation, and you know what they're telling you. You know, you can understand, yep. You can empathize, you know, with it. And it's not like you're talking to a brick wall. There's empathy, you know, there's confidence, because you have lived through it and got through to the other side, and you live to tell the story, so to speak. And it gives a lot of hope to other women, is what I believe. And I think that's what most women in their midlives need when they struggle with these things. And, you know, when the double whammy, you know, perimenopause, hormones, ADHD, all these things hit you, you really don't know where to go. And you lose hope. And once you start losing hope, the hopelessness can lead to depression. It can lead to anxiety symptoms. So recognizing these things early is the key, is what I would say.
What would it feel like to jump out of bed every morning in love with your career, your relationships, your life? If you find yourself lying awake at night wondering, who am I really? What would make me the kind of happy that doesn't fade after 2 months? Why am I clear on what I don't want to do, but clueless about how to figure out what I do want? Then join me for my free What Do I Do With My Life Masterclass, where we'll talk about how to become the expert on you and make better, quicker, and more confident decisions in your personal and professional life. Which of the many ideas that you have is the one you should actually pursue? And what would it really look like for you to live to your full potential? If this sounds like a fit for you, join me for my free What Do I Do With My Life Masterclass by going to spyhappy.me/class. See you there.
Yeah, I always say our best purposes give meaning to our past. So
exactly. Yeah.
That's when you become the best teacher, because you're so passionate about it too, because you want to help other people not struggle as much as you have.
Yeah, that is exactly, you hit the nail on the head, Tracy, there. So
okay, so I was telling you when we first started that I haven't had a doctor on the podcast for a while. And I think it's really important that we talk about ADHD and hormones, because I don't think it gets discussed enough. So the DSM-5 tells us that in order for ADHD to be present, the symptoms have to be present in childhood. And I can say for myself that I certainly had symptoms in childhood, but I think they were mild. I'll say they were primarily the good symptoms, like, you know, the drivenness, the no fear. I was chatty. Yeah. I could be a little impulsive in speech, but I felt like that almost looked like fearlessness. Mm. And I always felt different. I kind of beat to my own drum, but I never saw that as a negative, right? In fact, I loved that I was different. And it wasn't until perimenopause that these serious symptoms like bad working memory, brain fog, you know, procrastination, all of these things that, like I said, I thought I had early onset dementia, and I was actually tested for Parkinson's. And you had made the comment that all of a sudden you started to notice problems with organization and accounting and laundry and, you know, just cleaning and keeping things kind of together in your life. So my first question is, were you able to handle all those things before, even though they bored you, but all of a sudden everything started to unravel? Or were these things always a problem and you just ended up having to do more and more of them? And so that's when the wheels fell off the cart. Do you remember?
I think I found these kind of what I call as admin tasks very boring. You know, the laundry, the cleaning, the accounting. Oh God, do I have to do it? Or I'm a very last minute person when it comes to these kind of things, because you see with ADHD, it's a very interest-based thing. And if you're not interested in the activity, then you're not going to do it. So I think, you know, I probably got through it, struggling through it. I got a cleaner to help me with the cleaning. Laundry, you know, I had to do it because I had to stay on top of things to function as a doctor. Accounting, I hired an accountant. So I think I did some things well. But I think when it came to the perimenopause, because there were the physical symptoms to go along with the cognitive symptoms of, you know, both ADHD and menopause, is when I actually started to struggle. You know, there was this recent study, and I think the attitude, they had a webinar recently about it, you know, how there's an overlap of the cognitive symptoms of both ADHD and menopause. Apparently about 5 of the main symptoms in ADHD and 5 of the cognitive symptoms of menopause are exactly the same. And that includes the classic kind of triad of the inattention, the impulsivity, the hyperkinesis, you know, the kind of the restlessness. So if you look at it, I think there's always been a relationship between the low estrogen and the neurotransmitters. So the reason why women going into menopause struggle with ADHD, or the other way around, I mean, you mentioned the ADHD being diagnosed usually when your kids are diagnosed. But perimenopause, it kind of unmasks a lot of latent or hidden ADHD symptoms, or ADHD is diagnosed for the first time during the perimenopausal years. So it could be either of those two. And I think looking back, there are some ADHD traits I possibly had during childhood, but because of the firm boundaries within the structure of family and school, it never came out really. So it was kind of protected and it was probably overlooked, which I think happens in a lot of women anyway. But you mentioned the Alzheimer's. It's a very interesting one. And the main reason women have that issue with the memory is mainly because of the one of the neurotransmitters, which is the acetylcholine. And that's the one which can be affected in Alzheimer's as well. And because it plays a central role in your memory, especially shorter memory and your learning. So that's where you get the memory loss or the forgetfulness, the brain fog. You know, a lot of women say, you know, they've got a Swiss cheese brain. One of the psychiatrists wrote about it recently in the Daily Mail. Actually, there was an article about it in the Daily Mail newspaper about ADHD and menopause just 2 days ago. Daily Mail is one of the UK newspapers. And they talk about 2 women who are businesswomen and who struggle with these 2 symptoms. So it is real. It is there. And it happens.
Okay. So ADHD symptoms increase when estrogen decreases, and they decrease when estrogen increases. So, and that's in every woman, right? ADHD or no ADHD. So then you add perimenopause or menopause on top of that. When your estrogen is bouncing all over the place, right? And then going down, it's no wonder that we struggle with all of those executive functions that, you know, are, okay, wait, what am I trying to say? The executive functions that, it's dopamine. Right. Yeah, exactly. And dopamine is controlled, or I'm probably using the wrong terminology, but dopamine is affected by our levels of estrogen.
That's right, yeah. Because you see, estrogen, it kind of modulates the functioning of the neurotransmitters, the three main ones being dopamine. So the dopamine has the central role in ADHD, especially with respect to executive functioning. And it's the low levels of dopamine that cause the issues with in ADHD. And when you have low estrogen, that affects the dopamine as well. And then the next neurotransmitter that's affected, like I said, is the acetylcholine, which is to do with the memory and the learning. And the third one, which is also a very important one, is the serotonin. And that is central in the kind of regulation of your mood and your fear, and which leads to kind of depressive or anxiety symptoms in perimenopause. You see a lot of women who are fine driving suddenly during perimenopause. They are scared of going on the road.
Oh my gosh.
They have accidents. Yeah, because there's a lot of fear, and then they're just generally quite anxious. And, then they kind of lose keys, that forgetfulness, they can't get projects on time. Then the mood is there. And then you see, because you don't know, or if you don't know what is going on, doctors wrongly give you antidepressants, which is not, which will help with the serotonin side of things, but it doesn't really do anything about the estrogen side of things. So basically, a lot of women could be misdiagnosed or lately diagnosed with either of those two things. So that's where the estrogen and the neurotransmitters kind of have a relationship. And it's the estrogen fluctuations during perimenopause, which can last from anywhere between 2 to 10 years, which creates the hormone havoc. So it creates havoc to the system. You really don't know if you're coming and going. So it's kind of basically lost.
You know, Susan, I've never heard anybody talk about driving. So that is a symptom of perimenopause and menopause.
Yeah, it could be. It could be because of the effect of it on the serotonin with the mood, the anxiety.
So that's serotonin.
Yeah. So if you get on behind the drive, the wheel, and you're a bit anxious and, you're breathing fast, you're going to overlook, people walking in front of you, behind you, around you. Or if there's a lot of traffic, you could feel a bit panicky, restlessness, and then you're afraid you're going to have an accident, you're going to run, and the ADHD heightens, so you might be running late for an appointment. I'm always running late. So then you drive fast or you cut corners, you skip rules, and then you end up in an accident. And yeah, there you go. So the driving is a big one. I think a lot of patients have told me that they struggle with.
You know, I have never liked to drive. I have never felt comfortable behind the wheel. I think I probably had, I can't even remember anymore, but I think it was 4 accidents before the time I was 23, 24. Mm. But every single one of them, except for one, was someone running into me, right? So I was already anxious because I feel like there's so much going on, but I'm not one of those ADHD people who speeds at all. I'm actually quite cautious, but I've noticed over the last couple of years, I'm even more uncomfortable driving. And I think it's because I drive less. So I've been forcing myself because I'm afraid that pretty soon I'm not going to drive anymore, right? Because I'm going to be so anxious about driving. But it makes sense that it would be serotonin. And I just thought, oh, it's ADHD, but, the dopamine.
Yeah,
but it makes sense what you're saying that no, it's more likely that maybe it's the serotonin because it is something that got much more, and it's not serious, but I've noticed it more since perimenopause. Where it's gotten progressively, I just feel a little more uncomfortable every time, which is why I now force myself whenever I can. I'm like out and I'm driving. So,
as long as you do it gradually and within your comfort level, you should be fine. So, and I think like with any skill, if you stop swimming and you get back into the pool after a drowning accident, you may never get back. You have to get back on the horse, but do it within your own comfort level at your own pace. There's no point pushing yourself. But I think the reason why I mentioned driving as well is, during perimenopause, women, they're overloaded at home, between kids, elderly parents, their husband, their partner, and they need some breathing space. They need to go out, get some fresh air. And if you don't drive, you don't have to drive, you can go out for a walk. I mean, I don't drive at the moment, but you could go out for a walk, but it helps clear your head. So it is a very important part of you know, having your own space. It's a safe space within the car. You can listen to a podcast like yours.
Yes.
Or you can listen to music. You can do, or, you know, listen to Headspace or Calm, like a mindfulness music, whatever. So it's having your own space where you are in control. And even if it means just going 5 minutes down the road, going to a parking lot and sitting there for 20 minutes, I don't care. You know, as long as you get your me time uninterrupted.
Well, I think too, well, it's basically what you just said. It's the freedom, right?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Also, we can fall into this learned helplessness where pretty soon we can't really drive anywhere unless there's someone with us.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a confidence thing as well.
Yes,
and learned helplessness is one of the depressive symptoms. It's a negative automatic thought that comes in women with depression. You know, you think, oh, you know, I'm not good at this. So, you know, if you think, okay, I'm not good socially, and I'm not good at, you know, you're not going to go out or go to meet new people, go to parties if you're invited, because you've told yourself you're not good at this. You're bad at networking. You're bad at X or Y or Z. And it's a vicious cycle. So it's down to you. And the whole premise of even things like CBT, which is the cognitive behavioral therapy, is how you can challenge these negative automatic thoughts, the learned helplessness, through action or behavior. So you do something, you can suddenly change the neural pathways to kind of help you think differently. Because once you're on the road, or once you've done something which you thought were bad, you suddenly think, oh, wow, okay, if I can do this, maybe I can do X, Y, Z as well. Okay, maybe things are not as bad. So I think it just gives you a bit more hope and freedom, I think.
So going back to ADHD symptoms, I'm curious, what were you like as a child? Are there things now that, with the benefit of hindsight, you know, symptoms that you see or that you saw in yourself as a child that you think, well, maybe there was some ADHD there?
It's a tough one. I think probably the impulsivity and inattention. But I think, you see, the inattention, it was very interest-based. So, you know, if I didn't like anything, I wouldn't do it. And there was no point taking me or dragging me anywhere. And, you know, I wouldn't do it. And probably, I think, some of the things that did help, I think, going back in hindsight, is, you know, I took my parents sent me and my sister to some dance classes when we were like 6 or 7. I think, you know, the ADHD, the in coordination, that side of things was helped with the dance, because you see, you develop that kind of rhythm and coordination. So I think if I didn't dance, probably those things, some things would have kind of become apparent, you know, going into my pubertal years. The other thing I would probably say is learning languages. I lived, you know, in the Middle East, and then I moved to Asia when I was 10, and then been to the UK when I was 25. So when you have to transit through different countries, you become very adaptable. You have to learn different languages. So I think learning different languages, going to new places, meeting people from different cultures, kept that boredom away. Because otherwise, I think if I was stuck in one place, lived in the same village, I would probably be bored to death. And I think it's all down to how you view yourself and how you view the world. So it's kind of your map of the world is different when you're exposed to these things as a child. I mean, I still hate changes. You know, if I have to move Airbnbs on holiday, I get frustrated. I don't sleep. So, you know, that is there as well, because you see, it's that control and not knowing, that uncertainty. And women, they like to know. And I find that the older they get more controlling and they like more certainty. But you have to be very flexible. But I think, like I said, probably it was the inattention and the impulsivity as a kid. But I think it was controlled and tempered because of the things I mentioned.
Were you headstrong?
I think so. The thing as well is I'm one of a twin. And you see, she's a doctor as well. Growing up, you see, we never needed to interact with other kids. I mean, we didn't need to. We had friends, but we didn't need to. So I think there was a lot of protection that way. I think if we had normal, non-ADHD, you know, kids as friends at school, it would have become really apparent. So I think, you know, growing up, we believed there was nothing wrong with us. I mean, we never fitted in anyway, and because of so many other reasons. But I think being one of a twin, there was that protectiveness, and probably all these things were masked up until kind of later on in adult life.
Well, and you had your little community, right? So you saw your daughter, I mean, your sister, who was just like you, And so, of course, you were both perfect.
Yeah, we were both perfect, and we had our own language, and we had our own way of doing things. And you know, we both were really hardworking students. You know, I think it was probably part of the, you mentioned ADHD symptoms. I think it was part of people pleasing. You know, a lot of, I think girls in ADHD, especially in younger age, they are people pleasers. And I think it's a learned behavior. They learn that. So you see, I think one of the things I thought was, I don't want people to not like me as a kid. Is for example, mm-hmm. you know, I don't want them to hate me because I'm different. So I would rather do things to please them or fit in. And it doesn't help anyway because you're still going to stick out.
Yeah. Yeah. And I totally agree with you on the dance. I think ballet saved my brain. And I think there's a lot of research now that shows, you know, that balance is important. And neuroplasticity and all that. So I feel like ballet actually grew my brain in a different way.
No, I would totally agree. Some sort of rhythmic dancing or some sort of activity that involves coordination. The other thing we used to play was badminton. So it's a sport which involves quick reflexes. So I think it helped with any executive function, anything that lagged behind was helped with these activities. So I think any mothers out there with kids with ADHD, get them to do some sort of sport or dance and get them to learn different languages. I think it will help them a long way.
What has changed since you were diagnosed?
I think I'm more compassionate with myself. So I think that's the main thing. I think if you know yourself better, you have more compassion and patience with yourself. So now if I can't do things perfectly, or if I don't get things right, you know, at home or in the organizational side of things, if I'm a bit behind, I'm compassionate. Okay, that's fine, Susan. Also, if there's things, you know, I'm facing uncertainty about, it's like, that's okay. It's okay to not know. It's okay to just go with the flow. And so I think giving myself compassion, giving myself patience, giving myself the time to be me. And I think even rediscovering who the new Susan's going to be, like, once she's kind of through these curves of perimenopause and ADHD, I think you have to give yourself room. And I think you'll have to disappoint a lot of people and rocking the boat. You have to be willing to do it. I think it's one of those crucial phases in your life. You can't please everyone, and you have to be willing to rock the boat. And, you know, friendships, relationships around you, because the way people see you has changed, the way you see yourself has changed.
Yeah. You can't please everyone, so you may as well please yourself.
Exactly. And it's always, the saying I love is, it's easier to say sorry rather than say please. So when you ask for permission, that's where you run into trouble. If you upset someone, you can always say sorry at the end of the day. But you got to do what you think is right and sits right with you.
Yeah. And I'm sorry you feel that way, but I needed to do that for myself. What is it? Okay. It's better to ask for, I say this all the time, and now I can't think of what it is.
So it's easier to say sorry rather than please.
Yeah. There's another way that it said something about it's better to ask for
forgiveness, probably, yeah.
Yes, it's better to ask for forgiveness than permission or something that.
Yeah, it's the same. Yeah, it's the same lines. But because I think, you see, women, the way they're brought up by society, it's ingrained in them that they have to ask for permission. So, you know, look at boys or men, you know, including, you know, men I've dated or, you know, male doctors or colleagues. They hardly ask for permission. They just get on and do it. And if they get anything wrong, they'll say sorry. Women, they think they have to be perfect to start anything, do anything. And even the whole ADHD menopause coaching advisory service, I just launched it a couple of months ago. And in my own head, I'd been incubating this for a few months. But for me to get it out there, I thought, okay, no one's writing about it. It's not very well known. What if I have to go first? And what if people will say X, Y, Z? And, you know, I'm afraid of criticism. You know, the RSD, the rejection sensitivity is high in ADHD. And I think that's a trait I can identify with, because you're afraid of rejection, you know, rejection from peers, from family, friends, you know, what will they think? Or who the hell is she to go out and say, you know, there's a correlation? Because there are not many studies out there that have done it. Most of it is anecdotal. So, you have to, whatever you believe in, I think you have to have the balls to get out there and do it. And, you know, there's only one way to know if it'll work. If it works, it works. If it fails, it fails. And there's always a next step or a next thing you can do.
Right. And you learn something from it. So you take that and move on to the next thing. But you won't. You won't fail. I get so many women in the UK and, you know, and just everywhere in the world that they're just so frustrated because people, the medical professionals don't know about ADHD and they're just constantly being directed in the wrong place. And okay, so let's talk about what has worked for your patients to reduce ADHD symptoms and balance their hormones. And we're talking about those patients that come to you with perimenopause and or menopause type issues and ADHD symptoms that have been exacerbated because of it.
Yeah. I mean, I think identifying which one it is more likely to be, I mean, I guess it all stems down to a good history taking. You know, as doctors, that's, I would probably say that's the trait of a good doctor, to be kind of a good listener. So listening to the woman, if they come with both, you see, ideally, you don't want to treat both ADHD and perimenopause or menopause at the same time, because you can't really then tell which one has worked. So ideally, you would want to go with what the woman is more affected with. So if it is more the physical symptoms of the hormones or the perimenopause, which could be the hot flashes, the sleep problems, the weight gain, you know, loss of libido, all those kind of things, then you would probably want to focus more on the hormone and the estrogen replacement or the hormone replacement therapy. On the other hand, if they were struggling more with the cognitive effects and it was more ADHD symptoms, you would probably want them to go and get a diagnosis, see a psychiatrist or a specialist who specializes in it. And because there's that overlap, you really don't know which one needs to be treated first. You have to ask the woman, see what, you know, because women have a very strong instinct of what they think will work for them as well. But I think it's knowing that there are two variables in this equation. It could be physical of the hormones. It could be the hormones causing the cognitive symptoms. It could be the ADHD playing up as well. So ideally, if you have the resources, you would want to send them to both a hormone specialist or a menopause specialist and also an ADHD specialist as well. So you can know where they stand, you know, be it blood work with, you know, the hormones, be it the ADHD assessment. You know, they don't have to start treatment with any of these things, but if you know where they're at ADHD-wise or hormone-wise, then you get a better idea. The problem that happens a lot when there is overlap is you see the ADHD specialist won't know a thing about hormones. The hormone specialist won't know a thing about ADHD. So then the system is very fragmented. And where does this woman go? Who can, you know, connect all the dots between the mind and the body? And I think that's where I thought I could come in. And my service is more of a signposting. You know, I'm not a specialist in ADHD or menopause. I'm a family physician. I'm a general practitioner. It's more of my own interest, things that I've learned for myself, which I can impart. But I think someone who can look at the big picture, look at the whole picture and tell this woman, you know what, you know, this is what the hormone specialist has said or the menopause specialist. This is what the ADHD assessment has shown. And then the woman can make an informed decision, you know, what to do next, where to go. You need to kind of break it down, really. There is no one answer fits all, you know, unfortunately. And every woman is different. And, you know, I could be a twin and my twin would be completely different. But you see, every woman is different and they have to be heard separately, listened to intently. And then only can you arrive at the right solution for them.
So you are basically, I don't know, almost operating like a coach where you're helping them, a very educated coach who is helping them decipher all of these medical reports and information that they're getting, helping them synthesize and maybe process what they should do first, second, third.
Second thought. And then you see the menopause specialist, say, for example, tells them, you know, I think maybe it's good you try XYZ medications. And then the ADHD specialist turns around and say, you know what, you might benefit from some stimulants. And but the woman doesn't know, because no one's asked her about any of her other medical history, likely. I mean, I'm not saying they usually do during these assessments, but, you know, there might be many other factors in play, but they don't know where to start first. And when you see these specialists, then they're told, okay, what, we'll follow up in 6 months. What do you do between month one and month six? They're completely lost and they're in this kind of completely unknown field where they kind of lost and don't have support, because a lot of the specialists are super specialists. So you really need a generalist who can break down the information in a digestible format and give it to the woman and you know, empower her to make the right decisions for herself. So the signposting is, you know what, you can go down route A, you can go down A, B, C, D. It could be any of them. If, you know, my theory is if you go down route A and it doesn't work after 6 months, there's no harm in trying route B. So nothing is finite. Science is not finite either. So you have to be willing to try and listen to your own body, look at the evidence, look at what is helping, what is not, and be honest about it.
You know, my frustration in all of this has been how it's not integrative, just exactly what you said. Everybody knows their one little area, but they don't know anything beyond that. And so it almost becomes impossible. And even within ADHD, we have this idea that, okay, it's just ADHD. And so then the people who know ADHD don't know anything about dyslexia. And the people who don't know anything about dyslexia don't know anything about visual processing. I mean, it's just nobody knows at all. And so it sounds like what you're doing, certainly around hormones, women, ADHD, is integrating it or helping your, I guess, clients, it would be, versus patients, right? Your clients integrate. So does that mean, I would suspect, because women are probably pretty similar all over the world, that your expertise is not just limited to clients in the UK or where were you? You're in London and you're in...
I mean, I spent time between London and Dubai. But you know, I could consult from this coaching advisory service. I could consult with a woman from anywhere in the world, really.
Yeah,
because I think, the structures and, you know, the specialists in each country may differ, but the premise still remains the same. The fundamentals I would probably operate on would still be pretty much the same, but it can be tailored. I mean, I think, which is why I think having grown up in different parts of the world, you kind of can relate to most people in the world, because, you know, you've seen them all through your upbringing and the variety of it, and you have the confidence, you know, you can understand them culturally. You get, because you see culture plays a huge part, you know, the stigma around things, and, you know, some women might not speak up openly about it. You know, US, I was speaking to my ADHD coach the other day, and I was telling her, you know, the US is very well advanced ADHD wise, but I think the UK has a head start menopause wise. But then where do you go if you need both? So it is kind of that kind of in between area, that kind of shades of gray. No one likes the shades of gray. Everything is black and white, you see, and everyone likes black.
Especially in medicine, right?
Yeah, and you know, and everyone likes to operate within the remit of black and white. When it comes to gray, it's like people are not sure, and and a lot of professionals don't like the gray areas, to be honest. But I think willingness to go there, because if you have been there yourself, then it's easier to guide someone along the same journey, or a similar journey rather.
So I have a question for you.
Sure.
I'm curious if you have seen this in your clients at all, where, initially I was told it's perimenopause, hormone replacement therapy. I tried hormone replacement therapy and all different kinds of supplements, and they literally just made me nuts. I have also not been successful with ADHD medication, specifically stimulant medication, actually any of them. I've tried just about everything. Have you seen that be fairly consistent, where if hormone replacement therapy doesn't work, that often, you know, other kinds of, you know, well, ADHD medication doesn't either?
It can be seen in some women. I would probably say that is usually the case when there is more serious stuff involved. So say, for example, there's a history of trauma. So trauma is a big one, you see, because it kind of causes imbalance in the hormonal system right from the age of the trauma. And when you have trauma inbuilt, it affects the cortisol, which is a stress hormone. It affects the pituitary gland in the brain, which regulates the sex hormones. And then you have the defect on the brain from the dopamine. You have all this stuff. So trauma, you know, for me, is like a gaslight. It just lights everything on fire. So, and women may not respond to either either of those things until and unless the trauma is resolved, either through trauma therapy, EMDR, which is a specialized form of therapy, but some mm-hmm. sort of intervention to resolve the trauma. So it is like there's this huge layer kind of where the treatments of the hormones or the ADHD treatments, it's impervious. So it's not going to penetrate through the wall of trauma. So that's how I would see it. So I think in those women, unless the trauma is treated, resolved, or in, on some level, the treatments of hormones, ADHD may not be effective. Also the cases if there's anything physical going on, say, for example, physical-wise, thyroid issues would be a common one. Or autoimmune for that reason. And, you know, anything autoimmune, anything thyroid where there's chronic inflammation, you may not get the results of the intended results of hormone therapy. And going to the ADHD side of things, if there's more underlying mental health stuff like depression, anxiety, I don't know, OCD traits, any of those things, if there are, because, you know, ADHD never travels alone. You know, there's always a comorbidity with it. So it's identifying what is the most likely compatriot of ADHD in that woman. Most likely it might be anxiety, it might be OCD, it might be personality disorder. We don't know. I think you would have to break it down and go to the roots to find out if things are not working. So if traditional treatment, either in a hormone space or a ADHD space, doesn't work, you have to go back to scratch and start again.
You know, I don't know what it is, but I suspect that, and I never thought I had anxiety. I, you know, I say this often. I always thought I just caused other people anxiety. It wasn't until perimenopause that, and honestly, it was all the hormone therapy. And they told me you have a thyroid disorder, which I did not have. Yeah. They put me on Cytomel and I went hyper.
Yeah. Okay.
And that is what then, so there must have been some latent anxiety, right? That I didn't know that I had.
Yeah.
And honestly, I think it's kind of what has driven me too.
Yeah.
But that triggered something where all of a sudden then anxiety became something that I had to worry about. And the anxiety, normally I'm able to manage it just fine with exercise, but trying all these different medications is what just created more anxiety. And I am a slow metabolizer.
Yeah,
and so I think it's almost that we cannot get the medication up high enough without making me anxious so that it affects my symptoms, if that makes sense.
No, I totally agree. And, you know, and then you might have to take out all the medications and go back to, you know, grassroots level. So like you mentioned, it might be exercise, it might be looking at your diet, your sleep.
And that's what I've done.
Alcohol, which is where the whole lifestyle medicine approach comes in, you know, from my training. And it's kind of, you know, you go to the basics, you know, how's your sleep? Do you smoke? Do you drink? Do you like a glass of wine? You know, that's not going to help you with your anxiety, you know. Alcohol is a downer, it increases your anxiety, lowers your mood. So obviously that's not going to work. So you'd have to cut down on those things. You know, exercise helps, mindfulness helps. So, you know, it's, I think you have to declutter your life, I think, when you're in that stage. Yeah. And go down to basics and re-examine everything from the roots.
Yeah, I've given up on medication. I wish I was one of those people that, you know, when I had something really difficult to do, I could, stimulant medication would work for me, but I've given up on it. And I've had to, like you said, focus on sleep and exercise and making sure I'm living my purpose. And how about supplements? Are there any supplements that you've seen that your clients have had a lot of success with?
I mean, supplements is not that well researched either in ADHD or hormones. There are some supplements, you know, there's black cohosh, you know, there's a few different ones that people try and use. But I think it depends on the woman, really. You see, some of them have a placebo effect as well. There are women who swear by, you know, black cohosh, red clover. There's another one, the Australian bush essence oil, you know, there's a flower treatment. So, you know, all sorts of things that help with the anxiety and the sleep and stuff. And you give it to another woman and she'll probably say, no, that made me feel really bad. You know, CBD oil, that is a new one. You know, a lot of women use. I mean, there's not much evidence, but I think a lot of women I've met and they have kind of vouch for CBD oil. It kind of helps with the inattention side of things with ADHD and improves the focus in some women, but it also helps with the sleep and lowering the anxiety. So, you know, potentially that could be one, but you have to be careful. It has to be a good quality CBD oil. I mean, there are gummies and things that you can use, but every woman is different. There is no blanket approach to these things. You have to know the history of the woman, actually, which is why I think it goes back to, you know, speaking to her, listening to her properly, getting the whole story, because there are clues all the way right from childhood to adolescence, you know, what their periods were like, how were they hormonally, you know, did they have acne, you know, period problems, endometriosis, fibroids, you know, there could be so many clues dotted along their lifespan, which will give you a lot of clues as to what might potentially work for them. And, you know, from a stress side of things, there are so many adaptogens like rhodiola, there is ashwagandha, you know, all those things help with the cortisol level and kind of help with the sleep and stress and stuff. So there are so many things, but I think you're probably better off seeing a nutritionist or someone qualified in that area. You know, I can give pointers, but I wouldn't be able to say, you know, this is exactly the right thing for you. I think you're probably better off seeing someone who has experience dealing with you and, you know, providing a bespoke kind of nutritious plan. So I work with some nutritionists, you know, who are able to do that.
Yeah. No, it makes sense. Again, every single woman is different. Every single ADHD woman is different. You know, our brains. You're making perfect sense. So one last question. I have this theory. It's the last question before I ask you those last questions that I always ask.
Okay.
I have this theory that ADHD women care more than most about living to their potential. I did a little study in our group, probably about a year ago, and it was literally 98% of women that responded felt like they just cared more about living a life of meaning than their peers. And so my theory is when we're not living to our purpose, when we're not practicing our creativity, we don't feel good. And when they come to me, most of them don't even know what the formula is for them to feel better. But once they discover what's important to them, what their values are, what their strengths, passions, and purpose are, they immediately feel so much better. So I believe that it's not just medication. It's not just knowing it's ADHD and how does my ADHD brain work, but it's also understanding, you know, who they are in all this and what their purpose is, that it's multifaceted. And I'm curious what your thoughts are.
I would totally agree. I think the underlying belief in a lot of ADHDers, especially women, tends to be, you know, they were made neurodiverse for a reason. You know, the reason they have ADHD superpowers, like you call them, it's for so that they can look at things differently, do things differently, and see the big picture, connect the dots where most of the non-ADHD people wouldn't be able to see the patterns. So if you're given, it's kind of like if you see ADHD as a gift, then you would want to make sure you perform to the best potential, because it's like, you know, you're only probably going to be 10 or 20% of the whole population in the world. So if you're built that way, there must be reason why, and where do you then fit in the world, you know, professionally, personally, what is your role? What is your purpose? And the whole thing with the same, not just with ADHD, perimenopause, it's like your second birth. You know, you're reliving your adolescence. You're getting the chance to choose again. So what would you choose differently? You know, what would you do differently? And, you know, and I think a lot of the women, they feel empowered that they can make a difference. I think making a difference is a huge part of how ADHD women feel good about themselves. And it kind of ticks the box in their heart. You know what? I'm living my purpose because I can make a difference. I can be heard and seen. I think hiding is a big part of ADHD, especially in women. So I think when women have a voice and they can, you know, get that voice out, you know, by speaking, singing, writing, you know, the way they bring up their kids, you know, the way they do their job, you know, whatever it is, or their creativity, then they have a voice, then they're no longer hiding. And a lot of the shame associated with ADHD, perimenopause, goes away when you stop hiding. And it's really difficult at the start. And, you know, you have to push yourself through it. And once you stop hiding, it starts to get easier. And you have to not care what people think. I think that's just, you have to follow, you know, it's your own compass in your heart, which tells you, okay, this is where I need to go. The compass of joy, I think that's what I read in a book. You follow the compass of joy. So the little things that give you joy, you keep doing more of it, then you'll slowly realize your purpose. So that's what you follow. And if you're lost, you do one thing that makes you a little bit happier, then you'll know the following day, you might get another idea. So it's just one step at a time. You can't rush the process because it's a transformation, the metamorphosis, you know, from, you know, the whole usual caterpillar to butterfly thing. It's going to take time. It's really painful, but it's that end product you live for. The butterfly is so beautiful. It's free. It can fly. People admire it, look at it and say, wow, okay, look at its beautiful colors. So that's the vision you have to have in your own head of yourself, your future self. That's what keeps you going.
I love it. So Susan, what is your number one ADHD workaround?
I think being flexible and adaptable. Wherever you do it. And I think yoga and mindfulness, two things that have helped me stay flexible. You know, they say how you end up on the yoga mat is how you end up in life. So on that day, if you go on a yoga mat and you are feeling really stiff and rigid, you know mentally you're stiff and rigid that day. So you create that flexibility in your mind and your body, then you're flexible to your environment. And that is a key with succeeding, especially when you're going through such difficult transitions. You have to stay flexible, always be adjusting, you know, tuning in to your body, to what your mind says, being aware of things around you. So I would say yoga and mindfulness. I used to use Headspace, but now I use something called Calm. Every morning, first thing, 10 minutes, it's just easy to just switch off everything. And you know, you wake up to this really loud chatter in your brain of 101 things to do. So the 10 minutes in the morning makes all the difference, I think, for me.
I agree. So where can people find you if they want to know more about you and what you do?
I'm most active on LinkedIn or Instagram. So they can find me on it's at Dr. Susan Varghese. That's the Instagram.
And okay, LinkedIn say that again. Oh, at?
So at Dr. Dr. Susan Varghese. So it's my name.
Spell Varghese for us.
So V-A-R-G-H-E-S-E.
Okay.
Yeah. And LinkedIn is the same. If you just type in my name on LinkedIn, it'll show up. I've got a website as well. So it's www.drsusanvarghese.com.
Ah, you've made it very easy for us.
I think consistency, it's something I've had to do. So it's easy and, you know, people can remember things easily. When you start switching and changing so many variables, it's very hard to, and you have to be remembered, you see. I think remembered easily. So I think I just wanted to make my life easy, which is why it is streamlined that way.
Wonderful. Okay, so everything is basically Dr. Susan Varghese.
Yeah, Varghese, yeah.
Varghese. Okay.
Yeah.
So again, this is going to be in the show notes if you've missed it. Susan, thank you so much for spending time with us here today. I so appreciate you and what you do.
Thank you so much, Tracy, for having me. And I hope the listeners have had some sort of benefit. And I'm full of supporting women and empowering women to live their best lives. So, and thank you, Tracy, for the good work you do. So you started the talk for me. So it's a pleasure for me to be back here on this platform. So
wonderful. So that's what I have for you for this week. If you liked this episode with Dr. Susan Varghese, please let us know by leaving a review. Our goal is to change the conversation around ADHD, helping as many women as we possibly can learn how their ADHD brains work so that they too may discover their amazing strengths. And you know what? Your reviews really help. As always, you're listening to ADHD for Smartass Women. Come join me over at TracyOtsuka.com. Thank you for listening, and I will see you here next week. You've been listening to the ADHD for Smartass Women podcast. I'm your host, Tracy Otsuka, and we're available on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. Not coincidentally, ADHD for Smartass Women, it's also the name of our free Facebook group. We're a totally smart-ass community of successful, ambitious women who share our ADHD wins, questions, and workarounds. Join us at TracyOtsuka.com, where you can also find more information on our Your ADHD Brain is A-OK system. I spy a happier life for us, and I'll see you again next week. It's me again, Tracy. You know how people often assume that if you have ADHD, you're just lazy, unmotivated, and not living up to your full potential? Well, I'm here to tell you they've got it all wrong, except for the part about not reaching your full potential. But that's only because you haven't found the right strategies tailored for your unique ADHD brain. And that's exactly why I wrote ADHD for Smart-Ass Women. This book, it's designed to help you understand the different approaches that work for your distinct brain, inspiring you to become the best version of yourself right now. You can grab a copy wherever books are sold. And if you've already read my book, please take a moment to leave a review on Amazon and Goodreads. Your feedback, it not only supports me and my publisher, but it also helps other smart-ass women and their kids, friends, and colleagues find the strategies they need to thrive. Every review makes a huge difference. So go write a review now or buy the book now before you forget. Okay, back to our usual programming.